This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. No poet ever saw the mysteries of the world more clearly than Elizabeth Bishop, writes Lloyd Schwartz, who describes Bishop as among the 20th century's greatest poets. Lloyd has co-edited a new book called Bishop, Poems, Prose, and Letters, which has been published by the Library of America. Lloyd has written about Bishop for The New Yorker and edited a 1983 collection of essays about her. You probably also know Lloyd as our classical music critic. Elizabeth Bishop won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award and served in the position now known as Poet Laureate. She died in 1979 at the age of 68. Here's Lloyd Schwartz reading Bishop's best-known poem, One Art.
One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster.
Lloyd is going to read more poems from the new Elizabeth Bishop collection, but first we're going to talk about her life and work. You not only were a fan of Elizabeth Bishop's writing, you were a friend of hers. How did you get to know her?
She came to teach at Harvard. She was replacing Robert Lowell in 1970, and I was still a graduate student, although I was teaching and living in Cambridge. She gave a reading, and I had admired her work for years. She had already met Frank Bidart, who was a friend of mine and a classmate, and Frank introduced us after the reading, and I can reproduce our entire first conversation. I said to her, "Oh, Miss Bishop, that was a wonderful reading. I've admired your work for years." And she replied, "Thank you." And that was our entire first conversation. And it really took several years of, you know, running into her at, you know, at gatherings or cocktail parties or at readings. And one day I sort of screwed up my courage and invited her to lunch, and she accepted. And I think that was, in some ways, that was the start of something that really became a friendship.
Well, you include in the new Bishop collection a poem that she never intended to publish. It's called Breakfast Song, and it probably never would have been published had you not found the poem when she was still alive. There's a great story behind this poem that I'm going to ask you to tell.
Okay. We were just really beginning to get to know each other a little better. And that day that I took her to lunch, I had mentioned that I was going to be stuck in Cambridge over the Christmas vacation. And she said, well, she would be too, and maybe we could get together. And then I didn't hear anything, and Christmas passed, and New Year's passed, and shortly after New Year's, this was in 1974, my phone rang, and it was Elizabeth Bishop. And she called and was very apologetic. She was in the hospital. She had fallen and broken her shoulder. And she was in the hospital, and she knew that I was around, and she didn't know anyone else who was in town. And she asked me to come to the hospital, which was not very far from where I lived, and get her keys and go to her apartment and bring her back some items from her apartment, her purse, her mail, and a notebook that was on her desk. So I was thrilled to be able to do that. I was happy to do something for her. And I did, and I came, brought everything to the hospital. And then she had to be taken out of the room, I think probably for an x-ray, but I don't really remember exactly what it was for. And I'm sitting in her hospital room with her notebook. And I open the notebook, and there is this poem on the page, which I read. And I thought it was extraordinary. I thought it was just one of the best things by her that I had ever read. And I also, because it was very personal, there was something, some nagging sense that I had that I might never see this poem again. And I tore out a page, a blank page from the notebook, and I copied it. I copied the poem just so that I could live with it, so that I could read it. And I didn't tell her that I did that. And I'd hoped that, you know, in a year or so, or maybe she would publish it and that I would see it in print. And I didn't. And after she died, I know that scholars went through all of her papers, which were at Vassar College, where she was an undergraduate. And that poem never surfaced, and the notebook never surfaced. I don't know what happened to it. And 20 years after she died, I finally sent a copy to her estate and to her publisher, because I wanted people to know this poem.
And you've included it in the book.
Oh, yes.
And it's a beautiful poem, so I'm going to ask you to read it for us, and then we'll talk about it a little bit more.
I would love to. Thank you. Breakfast Song. My love, my saving grace, your eyes are awfully blue. I kiss your funny face, your coffee-flavored mouth. Last night I slept with you. Today I love you so. How can I bear to go as soon I must, I know, to bed with ugly death in that cold, filthy place, to sleep there without you, without the easy breath and night-long, limb-long warmth I've grown accustomed to. Nobody wants to die. Tell me it is a lie. But no, I know it's true. It's just the common case. There's nothing one can do. My love, my saving grace, your eyes are awfully blue. Early and instant blue.
I love that poem, and I love her description of death as a cold, filthy place.
Yeah.
Just again, this is a poem which you never intended to publish, and it would never, no one in the world would have known about it had you not copied it when she was in the hospital.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm grateful that you did. I'm sure everyone who reads her is grateful that you did, and yet, when you were doing it, did you feel at all like it was an act of betrayal?
Well, she didn't show me the poem. And so in some way, I was doing something behind her back. And I'm not exactly proud of that. On the other hand, I wasn't doing it for gain or you know, anything like that. I was doing it. I copied it because I loved the poem and I wanted to be able to read it and reread it.
The poem that you just read, which is part love poem, part fear of death poem, was, I assume, written for a woman because Elizabeth Bishop was a lesbian.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you think that's part of the reason why she was so uncomfortable publishing personal poems, because it's a truth about her life that she probably felt very uncomfortable speaking openly about.
I rather like to think about, I think I do think about it from a different direction, that she was someone who was, even from her earliest childhood, someone who was very private, who at least in theory didn't believe in making very personal things public. And I think it was more a kind of family trait than, you know, or cultural trait of, you know, a New Englander. Of course, I'm sure that the fact that she was also a lesbian heightened that sense of keeping things private, because it could be dangerous to let the public know about sexual orientation at that time. But I think this, I think it starts earlier than that.
You know, the breakfast poem that you just read, you know, we're talking about how she didn't like to be too personal in her poems. It's a poem that's at once very intimate without really being personal.
Mm-hmm.
It's about really intimate thoughts, but you have no idea to whom this poem is addressed,
right,
what their relationship is like. So you can't really read too much into the details of her life. She gives up nothing in terms,
right,
of that.
Except that she slept with someone.
That she slept with someone. We don't know, yeah, if it's a man or a woman, a young person or,
right,
an old person.
Right.
Now, there's another poem that I know you like very much called In the Waiting Room.
Mm.
And this is a poem that's really a memory of being not quite 7 years old in the dentist's waiting room while her aunt was actually in with the dentist. And while Elizabeth Bishop, the young Elizabeth Bishop, is in the dentist's waiting room, she's reading an edition of National Geographic dated February 1918. And as I was reading the poem, I thought, wow, that was a really old edition of the magazine. Who keeps magazines around for so many decades?
Mm-hmm.
What was such an old edition doing in the office? And then I realized, wait a minute, she was born in 1911, so this was the current edition. And it made me think about what a different era she was from. World War One was still underway at the time this memory takes,
yeah,
place. And so she was born into a different world, a different sensibility, like before radio and television and cars and, mm-hmm, you know, movies. And so I guess I wondered if you felt that reflected in your relationship with her or in her poems, that she emerged from another world.
Well, I think that's a very good question. And one of the things that I love about that poem In the Waiting Room is I think it's a kind of primary example of the way she deals with the dilemmas and contradictions of being a human being. And she's, you know, just about to be 7 years old and is having an identity crisis. But she's writing about it as she is about to turn 60 and still having an identity crisis. And what does it mean to be a human being? And what does it mean to have an identity? And how much one has to have an identity, and how terrifying it is to have an identity, to be stuck in an identity.
Why don't you read an excerpt of the poem? The poem's a little long for us to have you read the whole thing, but read your favorite passage from the poem. And before you read it, explain what was in the National Geographic that she was looking at in the waiting room.
Yeah, well, she's, of course, one of the things that the National Geographic was good for was to give you very exotic and even kind of sexual imagery. She's looking at pictures of African tribal women naked with their necks with these kind of neck braces wrapped around their heads, and they were frightening and fascinating, and that's what she's looking at in the waiting room.
Okay, read the passage for us.
I said to myself, 3 days and you'll be 7 years old. I was saying it to stop the sensation of falling off the round, turning world into cold, blue-black space. But I felt, you are an I. You are an Elizabeth. You are one of them. Why should you be one too? I scarcely dared to look to see what it was I was. I gave a sidelong glance. I couldn't look any higher. At shadowy gray knees, trousers and skirts and boots, and different pairs of hands lying under the lamps. I knew that nothing stranger had ever happened. That nothing stranger could ever happen. Why should I be my aunt, or me, or anyone? What similarities? Boots, hands, the family voice I felt in my throat, or even the National Geographic and those awful hanging breasts, held us all together, or made us all just one. How, I didn't know any word for it, how unlikely.
You know, it's like this memory of being seven years old and having this epiphany about the interconnectedness yet isolation of every human being. That's a pretty, pretty profound thought for a seven-year-old to be having. I know she's reliving this as a 60-year-old woman, but still, I can't imagine quite experiencing thought on that level at the age of seven.
Yeah, there's an interesting letter to Frank Bidart about this poem in which she says other people have talked to her, have told her about these kind of childhood epiphanies. Reading her poem in the New Yorker, that people remembered similar things that happened to them when they were children.
Octavio Paz once wrote an article about Elizabeth Bishop that was headlined "The Power of Reticence." Mm-hmm. And since, you know, you've talked about how private she was as a person and as a writer, what kind of example did she set for you as a poet about the power of reticence? Because, you know, really, there's a period, I think particularly in the 60s, when poets became almost like guru-like figures, they were very public. Particularly if you look at, say, like Allen Ginsberg as an example, who'd appear in like student unions around the country naked, and, you know, and had this incredible cult following. And he was so personal in his writing. And there were many other, you know, writers, you know, who were similar in having a very public and very large personality.
Yeah, it was around that time that Elizabeth said she believed in closets, closets, and more closets. I think the lesson for writers, why I love to teach Elizabeth Bishop and assign her poems to my writing students, is how economical her poems are. That she once said in an essay that she never finished writing, describing the poems that she liked best, that the qualities she most admired were accuracy, spontaneity, and mystery, which are three very interesting qualities, which I think really, she's really describing her own work. this wonderful eye for detail, this sense of living through the poem spontaneously. That is, you know how carefully written it is, but when you read the poem, you feel you're living through the experience as she is living through it, just as she's kind of reliving her childhood in the waiting room. But always with a sense of mystery, that there's something left to the imagination, that there's something between the lines. And maybe they are the qualities that exist in every great poem. So that's what one would like to aspire to as a writer.
Well, Lloyd, congratulations on editing the book, and thank you so much for sharing some of her poems with us.
Thank you for having me.
Lloyd Schwartz co-edited the new book, Bishop, Poems, Prose, and Letters. He's also our classical music critic. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a psychologist and family therapist, Dr. Dan Gottlieb has helped many people through some of the most difficult passages of their lives. He's also endured a great deal of physical and emotional pain of his own. Nearly 29 years ago, he was in a car accident that left him with quadriplegia, paralyzed from the chest down. On his first visit to Fresh Air, Dr. Gottlieb, or Dr. Dan as he's often called, described how he became devoted to his work after the accident. He subsequently made a mark in his field not only through his private practice, but through his popular radio show on WHYY Radio in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, his newspaper column in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and his books. His new book is called Learning from the Heart, Lessons on Living, Loving, and Listening. Dan, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Now, the last time you were here, you mentioned that you were part of the first generation with quadriplegia who have lived into their late 50s, thanks to advancements in medical science. So let me just start by asking you, how's your health now?
Not good. There have been some changes over the last two, three years, that have kind of told me that I've turned a page in my life. Quadriplegics, paraplegics are prone to a lot of urinary tract infections. I've always had a lot of urinary tract infections. And 2 years ago, I got one that just wasn't going away for the first time. All the antibiotics wasn't knocking it out. And the urologist said it's not going to go away. So we have to do all sorts of other interventions. I've been fine with that for a couple of years, but I know my days are numbered when the maintenance dose of the antibiotic isn't going to work. And then my heart rate dropped precipitously last summer, and I had to have a pacemaker put in. It was emergency surgery. Ordinarily, having a pacemaker in is no big deal. And within hours after the pacemaker was in, I was having wild, dangerous fluctuations in my blood pressure from 300 over 200 all the way down to, it was as low as 55 over 35 once. And more recently, my muscles have been fatiguing, and we might hear it through the course of the interview, even my intercostal muscles.
Which are those?
Fatigued. It's the ones that help me get my voice out, that force words out of my mouth. And I feel a kind of air hunger sometimes because I feel air hunger. And that comes and goes. And 80-90% of the time I feel fine.
You were saying to me right before we started the interview that you feel like your body's going in one direction and your career's going in the other direction. Can you talk about that a little bit more? To feel like your body is failing you in some fundamental way, but at the same time, your career just keeps, you know, taking off. Your previous book, Letters to Sam, did really well. It's published in 14 languages. You've got a new book that's just come out. You're doing a TV special. So can you talk about that paradox?
It's almost as though I'm watching a movie here, and it's really an interesting movie. You used language, though, that I disagree with.
Go ahead.
You said my body is failing me. And my language is my body is getting tired. I've got a different relationship with my body over the last 5-10 years. My body has served me nobly. It has worked very hard, way above and beyond.
Oh, see, I really like what you're saying, because what you're saying is that you're not having an antagonistic relationship with your body. It's like you know your body's had a hard time, and you're grateful to it for having hung in there and done its best.
Deeply grateful.
It's so easy to get angry with your body anytime something goes wrong. So I appreciate the distinction that you just made.
Yeah, deeply, deeply grateful. And I care for my body like it is a fragile lover that I adore.
Did it take you a while to reach that point of not getting angry with it?
Oh, yeah. After my accident, before my accident, I was a young man, so I was ashamed of it. And after my accident, I hated it. I felt betrayed by my body. And after that, you know, I said that I have to treat my body kindly, but it acts like a terrorist to me. And now I don't feel that way. When something happens, it's the voice of my body's exhaustion. That's how I feel. And I feel great compassion and gratitude for my body.
So getting back to my poorly worded question, mm-hmm. How does it feel to have your body feel increasingly tired while your career is getting bigger?
It depends on what time of day you ask me. If you ask me in the middle of the night when I can't sleep, I'll say terrifying is how it feels. But during the day, it's really interesting. I don't know where it's going to go or what's going to happen. I'm going to ride it as long as I can ride it. I am clear about why I work. I am clear about what my life means to me. And I am clear I am living a meaningful life.
You've had several near-death experiences because of the quadriplegia and related problems of that. Does this feel fundamentally different? I mean, because you've always pulled through.
Yeah, it does feel different. I've had a couple of doctors say that they thought my body was wearing out. My body feels tired. It doesn't feel emergent, what's happening to me. I could live another decade. I certainly hope I do. It doesn't feel emergent, but it does feel like my life is getting smaller. Now, watch, we could turn around a week from now and, you know, I could be fine. But the way I feel now, my body is getting tired.
Yeah, and we talked about this the last time you were on the show, but for people who didn't hear that, just tell us briefly about your accident, like what happened.
I was driving westbound on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, December 20th, 1979, and an 18-wheel truck was driving eastbound, and a wheel broke off the truck, not just a tire, the whole wheel, metal frame and all, and bounced across the turnpike and crushed my car. The last thing I remember seeing was a big black thing in the sky coming down, and seconds later, of course, my life was forever changed. I believe, though, that most of us have been hit by a black thing, that in a millisecond, your life is forever changed. You're no sidewalk under your feet, and you're in free fall. You know, it's a doctor saying, I think it's malignant, or a spouse saying, I don't think I can do this anymore, or a sudden death of someone you love. It's what's happened to me is not unusual at all. Looks different, but at the deepest levels, it's not unusual.
I'm trying to remember whether it's in your book or in one of your recent newspaper columns that you wrote about how in dealing with your own anxiety, and like most of us, you have your share, you, among other things, do meditation.
Yes.
And you describe, once a 3-day like meditation retreat. You come home and, you know, that night, 2 a.m, you wake up with this big anxiety attack. Your heart is beating. And you're basically talking to your anxiety, saying, it's been 5 hours since the meditation retreat, and already you're not leaving me alone.
And I devoted 3 full days, full time, to caring for my mind. It gave me 5 hours, not to mention $400 for this damn retreat. And there's the mind agitated. But I want to put that in context for you.
Yeah.
About 6 months ago, a friend of mine was concerned about her 8-year-old son. He watched films of 9/11, and now he was scared all of a sudden of airplanes flying in his window. And they didn't know whether to see, he needs to see a therapist, if something should be done, if she can be, do. And I usually don't see kids that age, but I do it informally over coffee, the three of us talk. And I told him, I heard the story, and I told him, you know, this is an age where we learn about death, where we start thinking about death, and it's pretty scary. I said, some people get over it, and some people don't. I said, I didn't. I said, I was scared to death when I was your age, and my fear was the boogeyman. The boogeyman was under my bed, and I thought if I laid still and didn't even move my eyeballs, the boogeyman wouldn't get me. I said, but I was scared to death every night I went into bed. So this kid looks at me, and he says, so where's the boogeyman now? The boogeyman ever go away? And I've got this deepest, but you can't lie to a kid that age because they'll catch you, you know. So I said, I'll tell you the truth. I said, the boogeyman's still under my bed. I said, but after all these years, boogeyman's old and he can't hurt me anymore. You know, he's been there all, he just doesn't have the strength to hurt me. So he's there. I don't get scared of him. He's like an old buddy after all these years. And that's my relationship to my anxiety. You know, it's there. I don't particularly enjoy it, but I don't know what I'd do without it. Wouldn't be me.
How do you distance yourself from it? Like when you wake up with your heart beating in the middle of a big, you know, anxiety attack, how do you not get totally caught up in the panic?
It's my mind. I just watch my mind doing what it does. And because I'm able to watch my mind now, I'm able to use the data from my past.
What do you mean?
Well, the data is every time I've had a panic, it hasn't lasted for the rest of my life. It hasn't been real. It always passes. Another emotion is always there waiting to come right around the corner. So when I'm in the middle of this panic, I'm not suggesting I don't suffer. I suffer the same way that, you know, the rest of my neurotic cohorts suffer. But there's a quality of knowingness that I have. There's an observer inside of me that observes with compassion. I feel the same way about my mind that I feel about my body. I feel the same way about me that I feel about my body.
So you're not really angry with your mind for having the anxiety that's leading to the panic?
No, it's my neurotic mind. I mean, it's me. You know, it's me. Meditation is really about paying attention. Enlightenment is simply about shining a light on what is. And the more you pay attention to exactly what you're feeling, rather than try to fix it, the less likely it is to stay for a long time, because you're going to be aware of another feeling coming around the corner.
Do you or have you ever taken like anti-anxiety pills or antidepressants? I mean, you're a therapist, so you know your way around these drugs. I'm sure you've had many patients who've been on them, and you've had suggestions about whether they should remain on them or not. When it comes to yourself, do you think that you should get an assist from an anti-anxiety pill when you know that it threatens to get the better of you for a while?
Sure. I've got a history, Terry. I think I might have mentioned it, of clinical depression. And clinical depression is a serious illness of one's brain, and it needs treatment. And I take a low dose of an antidepressant every night, partly to help with insomnia and partly to keep a baseline of antidepressants on board. I think antidepressants are abused. It's a great concern to me. And when they're used appropriately, they're a godsend. You know, we talked about compassion for my body, for my mind. To take these medications is really an act of compassion for your brain. Your brain is suffering when you're depressed. It's in an unhealthy environment. It's being assaulted. And it's an act of compassion for one's brain to get help.
in your new book, Learning from the Heart, or maybe it was in your newspaper column, you tell a story about after your father died and you went to the funeral parlor to give them personal effects to put in the casket with him and to examine, you know, how they'd prepared the body. You noticed that on his head they had put on the prayer cap, the kippah or yarmulke. And you had to think, well, my father wasn't really a believer, so should I ask him to take it off or should I leave it on? Tell us what went through your mind and what you did.
My father was more than a non-believer. He was a passionate atheist, my dad. So I thought, well, should I take it off to respect him? And then I thought, well, what if, you know, who knows and what's it mean? And, you know, maybe there is somebody up there and maybe there's somebody's judgmental. And I had him take it off. I finally decided. I called the funeral director. And all this ruminating took, you know, 5 seconds. So my relationship with my dad was I always crapped around with him. I mean, my sense of humor comes from him. He didn't have a good sense of humor, but he laughed so easily, and I loved to crap around. So I have the funeral director come, and he takes the yarmulke off and takes it in the back. And there my dad and I are alone there, and I look in the casket, and I say, you owe me one for that. First time he didn't laugh. I was half expecting him to.
So you wanted to respect his position as an atheist. Are you a person of a faith? Are you an atheist?
I am a person of faith, and I go to synagogue almost every Friday night, and I don't believe in the God they pray to.
Okay, you can explain that.
No, I can't. I can try. I believe there is something divine in this life, in me, in you. Our most solemn prayer, the Shema, says God is one. And I take that literally. So what does that mean? Well, maybe what it means is when we are one as a people, or even at this moment when we are one, maybe that's God. Right there at the moment, or the marquee at a church around the corner from my house that says God is love. Well, maybe. Maybe it's the other way around, too. I don't know. But I do believe there's something divine in us, between us, and in this life. And I think my job, my personal beliefs, is that little piece of divinity in me, my job is to know it, to honor it, to grow it best I can every day, every year. I'm not real good at it, but I'm trying.
So will you leave this world thinking that there is something beyond this world?
No.
No.
I will leave this world thinking, damn, I wish I didn't have to leave. I believe that I will live on to the extent that other people carry me with them.
Afterlife is memory.
Yeah. So, you know, probably my grandson, Sam. But, you know, my body, you know, I'll continue after I'm dead. My body will continue what I'm doing now and trying to nurture the world best I can. So I'll nurture, you know, that small area of the environment. I just had a conversation with Sam when I was going through all these.
I should mention, Sam is your autistic grandson to whom you dedicated your previous book. It was called Letters to Sam. And the book was written in the form of letters to him.
Right. And Sam's doing really well,
good,
by the way, really well. And we have a wonderful relationship, and he torments me about being bald. And I try I try to take it like a man, but I one day I failed, and I explained to him in six-year-old terms the genetics of baldness. And I told him he was going to have my hairline when he grew up, which he refused to acknowledge. So anyway, when I went through these acute health crises this summer. Sam pulled me aside, and he said, "Pop," he said, "how old am I going to be when you die?" It opened up a wonderful discussion about death, and I asked him what it meant to him and what he was worried about. So he said he was scared that he would miss me, that he wouldn't see me again, and I asked him what he thought would happen to me after I died. And he described his version of heaven, the kind we tell kids. And I said, "Sam, if I am in heaven, do you think I'll still be loving you up there?" And he said, "Well, sure." And I said, "Will you still be loving me?" And he said, "Well, yeah." And I said, "Sam, do you think you'll be able to feel my love for you?" And he said, thought for a long time about that. He said, "I think I will, Pop." So I said, "So we have that going on. So death isn't going to stop that part. It's not going to stop the love part. It'll stop the visiting part, the seeing part, but it won't stop the love part." And Sam seemed to feel a bit better. And I said to him, "Sam, there's one more thing." I said, "If you're right, if there is a heaven up there, and if I'm up there," I said, "when you get older and you start to lose your hair, I'm going to laugh my ass off at you."
My guest is psychologist and family therapist Dan Gottlieb. A car accident nearly 29 years ago left him paralyzed from the chest down. You've got a new book called Learning from the Heart, and your previous book, Letters to Sam, which was Letters to Your Autistic Grandson, that did really well. Printed in 14 languages, sold a lot. And you were telling me before the interview started, I didn't know this, that you donated all the royalties to charity. And I'm thinking, like, that's a that's a really generous thing to do. I mean, why did you decide to do that?
Well, I've got to be candid. Part of my thinking comes from my ethnic background. And my that says to me, if I was going to keep the money, I wouldn't make any money. And if I'm going to give it away, it's going to make a lot of money.
Oh, so you committed before you knew it would make money. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I did, actually. I did.
Okay.
I think I've made it clear. I like my life. I really like it the way it is. I'm very happy with my life. And in terms of money, you know, I can pay my mortgage and I can take myself out to dinner almost whenever I want. I can take a couple vacations a year. So, you know, so what? So what do I need more money for? And there's so many people in this world in so much pain, and so many children are suffering. And, you know, what am I going to do? Buy a couple more suits? You know, it's the best feeling I've ever had, Tari. It's just a wonderful feeling.
Since you've talked about how you fear your body is getting tired and that you've turned a corner, do you mind if I ask you a couple of questions about facing a body that you feel is getting tired? Do you get scared of what that means?
No. I might sometimes in the middle of the night, but by and large, no. I feel sad. But when I am living with death, I'm living with life. I'm more alive. When I feel death nearby, I feel life nearby. They go together. And I think to a certain extent, that's true for all of us. I refuse to believe I'm different from anybody else in that regard.
But do you still worry about what the circumstances will be? Because so many people just obsess on that. You know, will I be in pain? Will I be alone? Will I be at home? Will I be in the hospital?
I know all those answers, most of them.
You do?
I don't know about the pain, but I'll be at home. I'll be with a nurse because that's how I live. So all the stuff that most people worry about, I've been there. I've done that. Two stories.
Yeah.
One is I tell a story about a patient I saw years ago who was obese and had two artificial knees, and he was sitting in a chair in a session. The chair was probably too low, and he labored to get out. And you could see he was working really hard to get out of the chair. And he gets up, and he takes a breath, and he looks down. He says, you know, he said, I probably shouldn't say this, but I look down at you, and I think, thank God I can get up. And I said, well, I shouldn't say this either, but I look at you, and I think, thank God I'm not going to have to go through all that when I get older. And I felt the same thing with in Tuesdays with Maury. There was one point early in his disease where he says to Mitch, oh, my God, somebody's going to have to wipe me one day. And I'm reading this, and I'm thinking, you get used to it. And you get used to stuff. So all of the things that people are afraid of, becoming dependent, winding up in a wheelchair, having an attendant with them full time, I've been there. It's not that bad. You get used to stuff. So, I didn't think much about pain. I really hope that doesn't happen. But I'm not afraid. I'm mostly sad because, for obvious reasons, I love my life so much. I love almost everything about it.
Dan, it's really been great to talk with you.
And you, Terry. I appreciate our time together.
Dr. Dan Gottlieb's new book is called Learning from the Heart. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.